Hey, it's me, Dave from before, Dave Hill from Show Business. And if you live in New York City or know how to get there, you can see the Novelizers live in person this Wednesday, July 9th at Caveat in Manhattan. We'll feature some hilarious chapters from our novelizations of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, narrated in person by H. John Benjamin, Dave Foley, Chris Redd, and an exclusive epilogue by me, Dave, mentioned earlier. Get tickets at caveat.nyc, and I will .nyc you there. This week on the show, Nathan Fillion, Matt Walsh, Stefan Syracek, plus me, Dave Hill. What? It says butt aficionado here. What the hell? Who writes this stuff? It's the Novelizers, and I'm disgusted.
Don't want your popcorn. Don't want your milk duds. Don't want my shoes stuck in pools of sticky cola. Don't show me romance. Don't show me fist fights. Just show me words printed out in other book lights. Yeah, baby, Novelize the movie. Give me sentences, paragraphs.
Welcome to the Novelizers. We've got a great show. And we have a special surprise guest once again in the studio this week. I don't know how we do it. It's Mr. Steve Agee.
Oh, my God. Steve.
I feel like you're using the word surprise pretty loosely.
Well, we don't want to give anyone a heart attack.
We have a special expected guest in the studio this week.
There you go.
Well, you might not be surprised, but you are special. And you are a guest.
Oh, yeah.
Steve, I know you just arrived in this podcast, but can you tell me who's on the show this week?
Goddamn right I can. First, we got Stefan Syracek, a writer and filmmaker whose work has appeared in McSweeney's, New York Magazine, and National Geographic.
Oh, I love
the magazine that's got them big-nippled ladies.
We do not have a lot of National Geographic writers on this show.
No, we don't.
Certainly not enough.
And we also have Nathan Fillion. How did we swing that? Nathan's known for his role as Captain Mal Reynolds in the cult favorite series Firefly and the film Serenity. And opening this week, Nathan stars as the Green Lantern in the new James Gunn Superman reboot. You can also catch Nathan starring as Officer John Nolan in ABC's hit series The Rookie.
Also, Matt Walsh, comedian, actor, and writer who co-founded the Upright Citizens Brigade. He's known for his role as Mike McClintock in HBO's Veep, and he's appeared in films like The Hangover and Ghostbusters.
What a star-studded episode. How do we do it, and how can people help us do it? Anyone?
I'm guessing Patreon.
You're right.
Yeah.
Everyone
throw their money at the show. Go to Patreon, search the Novelizers, and just bleed out from your bank account.
You can just use a credit card. You don't even need to withdraw cash from the bank.
Maybe you follow one less porn star on OnlyFans and put that money to Patreon.
Yeah.
I love how we're making everyone feel shitty about themselves as a way to get... Hey, loser.
It works.
Please send us money. Where are we in the story?
I'm glad you asked. Johnny and Baby say goodbye. Lisa and Baby make amends. All the resort guests attend the Kellerman's final performance.
Dave Hill, where are we in the story?
Oh, I'm glad you asked. Johnny and Baby say goodbye. Lisa and Baby make amends. All of the resort guests attend the Kellerman's final performance about Unity. Doc discovers that Robbie, not Johnny, was the one behind Penny's pregnancy, which happened as a result of sexual intercourse.
I didn't see that coming.
No, I didn't see it. Oh. There's so much porking in this movie.
A lot of porking in this movie.
We'll fix it in post. Nathan Fillion. Novelize me.
Novelizers. Dirty Dancing. Chapter 16. Novelized by Stefan Syracek. Narrated by Nathan Fillion. Johnny shut the door of his dusty Chevy and stood in front of Baby, looking at his shoes. They both looked at their shoes, and they both had the same sad thought. I need new shoes. Baby put her head to Johnny's chest, and he rubbed her arms with his strong hands, reading her goosebumps like Braille. Sexy Braille. Ah, shoot, Baby. Without me around, you'll have more time for playing croquet, arranging flower bouquets, and practicing with your tennis racquet. Baby laughed. hoping it was a joke and not the result of Johnny's illiteracy. But what will you do, Johnny? Where will you go? Ah, shucks, baby. I'll be all right. I drive a 57 Chevy. Considering it's only 1963, that's a pretty impressive vehicle for a gigolo. Baby put her soft head back on Johnny's rock-hard chest. She could hear a plaintive saxophone on the wind, but it wasn't quite jazz. It was something even worse. Adult contemporary. I guess we surprised everybody, said Baby, hoping Johnny would lift her chin like Humphrey Bogart and say something timeless and romantic. I guess we did, hot stuff, said Johnny. I'll never be sorry. Neither will I, said Baby. Except about that one thing we tried with the cottage cheese. Yeah, sorry about that, said Johnny. I saw it in a magazine. That's all right, said Baby. The rest was just swell. Ah, shucks, said Johnny, giving her a melancholy thumbs up and getting into his car. Baby held back tears and a cloud of butt-colored dust rose up as Johnny peeled out of the lot and out of her life. Back at the cabin, Baby had just finished tragically rolling up some pantyhose and was about to go stare tragically into the middle distance when her sister Lisa wandered in to check on her. Baby was touched by her sister's concern, but there was no time to explain the world to Lisa. It would take too long, and she'd keep asking you what the big words meant. So, they just sat there touching heads and let the meandering saxophone wash over them like the sound of a soothing elevator. You're kind of pretty too, you know, said Lisa. Sure, you have a pancake bust and a matzo bottom, and while I'm shaped like an hourglass, you're shaped more like a hot dog. But your nose is perfect. Thanks, said Baby. Sure thing, said Lisa. Do you have any snacks? Mom only has gin. That night at the lodge, the Houseman family sat silently at their banquet table, the rotating lights overhead rhythmically splashing their faces with purple and pink. Doc glowered at the stage, gripping his scotch like a fading erection. All the busboys and fry cooks and other seasonal geeks were arranged on stage in ridiculous costumes for their annual schmaltzy farewell song. Kellerman's pencil-necked scion, Neil, had a pretty decent soprano, but it didn't do much to sweeten Doc's bitter mood. Kellerman's, we come together. Yeah, yeah, grumbled Doc into his glass. He wasn't feeling the spirit of unity tonight. His family had been in open rebellion all day, and he felt like he was fighting a war on all fronts. Compared to his daughters, Normandy had been a day at the beach. It was barely 8 o'clock, and his wife was 3 fingers deep into her bourbon, and Baby was giving him the silent treatment, which was no surprise after their heart-rending confrontation at the gazebo. Doc's face trembled with emotion at the memory of how his face had trembled with the emotion that morning. In that moment, he had wanted nothing more than to sweep his daughter into his arms, hold her tight, and throw her in the lake to splash some sense into her. But mostly, just to hold her and say that he was sorry. Instead, he had just sat there, glued to his chair like an abandoned marshmallow from an aborted s'more. That smooth operator, Johnny Castle, had come by to plead Baby's case, but Doc hadn't wanted to hear it. He still hated that his daughter was mixed up with these ragtime Charlies. All that recreational thrusting was unnatural, and they'd all need hip replacements by the time they were 40. Maybe next year they should go to Grossinger's. These flapper shenanigans would never fly at Grossinger's. Thief or not, that Scotch-Irish beatnik seemed like a fast guy, and he'd always thought of his daughter as a slow girl. Not as slow as her sister, of course, but Baby had a good head on her shoulders and a well-calibrated moral compass. He and Marge had seen to that. How had things gotten so twisted around? Baby was a good kid, on the fast track to a top women's college and a happy life. How she'd gotten mixed up with these hip-wagging carnies, he'd never know. Life used to be so much simpler. Doc thought back to when he was young, just a zygote with his whole life ahead of him. No, that was too far back. He didn't have sensory organs yet, so he thought forward to his teen years. He hadn't been Dr. Houseman back then, or even Mr. Houseman. He'd just been Jake. He thought back to long summer nights spent shooting spitballs with the guys, tooling around in his Lincoln, and necking with Becky Wexler at Peekaboo Point. In the fog banks of memory, he could still hear the jingle that would play every 5 minutes for Slick Nick's Evershine Pomade. Cool cats choose Slick Nick's. He was still a cool cat. Still had the straight back of a regional train conductor and the flat stare of a boreal owl. Heck, he still used Slick Nick's pomade. It was was the world that had changed. "Join hands and hearts and voices." Doc came back to reality and realized that his simpler daughter, Lisa, was up on stage gleefully showcasing 93% of her body. That dopey-looking pirate next to her better keep his hooks to himself. Oh, God. Now she was singing. The poor thing. Just then, Robbie Gould went sauntering by in a smart jacket, and Doc sprang to his feet, eager to support a young male who didn't fit him with such conflicting emotions. That Robbie was a straight shooter aiming right at the stars without a moral stain on him. Seemed like the marrying kind, too. "Robbie," Doc called out, handing the young go-getter an envelope containing a generous check. "Good luck in medical school, son. Something tells me you're going to make a wonderful gynecologist." "Hey, thanks, Daddy-O," grinned Robbie. "And thanks for helping me out with the whole penny situation," he added, poking his finger in and out of his fist to pantomime coitus, puffing out his belly to pantomime pregnancy, and then hanging himself with an imaginary noose to pantomime abortion. "What?" barked Doc, seizing back his cash like a dog seizes a wet bone. Doc stalked back to his table. Were there no straight shooters anymore? Had the whole world gone funny? His daughter was right. He'd misjudged Johnny Castle. He'd been blinded by that dangerous working-class chin, those meaty dockworker hands, and that itty-bitty waist. Maybe he really was a bourgeois hypocrite who talked about equality but judged people by the size of their vocabularies and the state of their shoes. He'd been quick to assume the worst about Johnny, when really it was Robbie who was the bum. Class markers be damned. You couldn't buy class. Not really. You could polish a turd, and you could dress it up in a little waiter outfit if you were a real kook, but it still stank to high heaven when you got up close and took a whiff. In the darkest corner of his heart, Doc wished that Robbie would fail out of medical school and meet with some gruesome fate like cleaning windshields at an intersection or attending a lesser Ivy. It wasn't kind, but that's how he felt. The only thing Doc hated more than medical malpractice was a scoundrel. Doc flagged down a waiter. Right now, his mouth tasted as sour as old aspirin, but he'd wash it out, first with hard alcohol, then with mouthwash like his dentist had recommended. Watching the show from the wings, Max Kellerman forced a smile, even as he murmured his concerns to his bandleader, Tito. His belly was voicing concerns of its own. That Danish from earlier may have been pure protein, but it had been giving him nothing but gas. "I feel like it's all ending, Tito," said Max, shifting uncomfortably. Tito nodded, leaning away from his flatulating employer. "Kids don't want to come to Kellerman's to have secret affairs with hunky blue-collar dancers anymore," complained Max. "Now taking trips to Europe to have secret affairs with hunky blue-collar olive farmers is the big thing." Max stared into the crowd, let out a contemplative toot as Tito edged further away. "Maybe we can hire some olive farmers next year," murmured Max. "Maybe that would work." Baby sat miserably in the corner, pressing her head into the decorative masonry. Max Kellerman was on stage doing his end-of-season Unity shtick and looking happy as an old clam. Unity. Yeah, right. Baby Houseman didn't like to swear, even in her internal monologue. But it was all a bunch of hooey. Baby's eyes blurred with adult tears. She felt small. She felt cornered. She felt like a small baby who'd been put in a corner. It wasn't a good feeling either. It was crappy. Her father was brooding in silence, and the fumes coming off her mother's triple tickle were making her woozy. She wanted to run to Johnny, to mambo into his arms and soar. She wanted to stand in front of these crusty upper crusters with their three-piece suits and their two-piece hair, look into their cold Westchester eyes and really show them. Everyone here was so buttoned up, so tight, so anal, but there were fissures. Someday, it would all tear wide open, and it wasn't going to be pretty. More than anything, Baby wished she could heal all of America's deep socioeconomic divides with one eye-catching dance number. Or, better yet, a show-stopping acrobatic stunt. But those were childish, virginal thoughts, and she wasn't a child anymore, and she was 5.5 times not a virgin. It was time to grow up. This was the real world, and it was stiff and cruel, and had two left feet. Johnny was gone, and he'd taken his chin and other parts with him. It was the pits. But that's just the way it was. This wasn't the kind of pain you could dance away.
Thank you, Nathan Fillion. We'll be right back.
And we're back. Each week on the show, we interview someone who worked on the film Dirty Dancing. Let's hear that interview right now. I don't know. I think we should, right, Steve?
Why not? What else are we going to do?
Let's go. Hurry it up.
Hello. I am here with an interview portion of The Novelizers. And today I am talking to Clint Hotteray, who was the cosmetician for Patrick Swayze on the set of Dirty Dancing. Hi, Clint. How are you?
Howdy. I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing great. So I honestly have no idea what cosmetician is. So I'm thrilled to hear about what you did on the set and especially, you know, with Patrick himself.
Well, I was back then a certified cosmetician. So I work in the beauty industry. And with Patrick, I was basically responsible for maintaining that hairless skin, that perfect top half of his body. Mostly the makeup artist took care of the face, and I had kind of from the neck down to the waistline.
And so taking care of skin, we just want as much shiny, beautiful glow on that chest and back as we can get. Is that right?
Well, I would say glow would apply. Shiny doesn't work in what I'm doing. I don't want shiny. And because that reads sweaty and that reads oily. You want a nice pH feel. But depilatory devices were a big part of what I did. Patrick, I don't mean to speak ill of the dead. He was a wonderful man, but he was a lot hairier on the back than he was in the front. But mm-hmm. there were patches of hair that he had decided he would shave himself, and they became problematic and ingrown. So we had a lot of tussles with this here sternum region with some, you know, follicles that were just a little on the borderline of being infected and such. So I kept busy with the depilatory devices and popping pimples a little bit, small ones, blackheads.
Can you say again, depilatory devices?
Yeah, depilatory are things that remove hair. Like you can use Nair. Back then we used Nair. We just rub on
skin. And
it stings. Yeah. You can use devices that kind of pluck it. You know, I use tape sometimes.
Just rip it out.
Just rip it right out like a strong duct tape or a package tape. Patrick preferred that. He was a rugged man, and he was ready to rumble whenever, you know, we saw something on set. Sometimes they'd cut, and, you know, do you want to go back to the trailers? No, he's just, get the tape. Let's just do it right here.
Yeah, get it done in front of people and everything. Just let's just make this happen and get right back into shooting.
Yeah. He was a friend of production. We call that a friend of production.
So, tell me, did you know Patrick before this film? Were you working with him in this capacity before he booked this role? Or it sounds like you said, you know, he did some shaving on his own and then you kind of came in and fixed some rough situations on his body. So what was your relationship getting involved with the film?
Yeah, we did some high school theater in Houston together. I was in the makeup department and he was, you know, the star and all that. And then we lost touch. We kept in touch, you know, our moms and such would keep each other abreast. And he was in Hollywood making his way, New York and such. And then when he had the run in with some bad advice on how to shave it and some bad cleansers, he called me up and he said, get your ass out here to Carolina. I need some help.
So he phoned a friend.
Yeah. I didn't ask any questions. I just got on a plane and headed out there, and I had my work cut out.
And what did you say to him when you got there? You said, I'm here. We're not going to have any more issues. I've got you, bud. Like, were you just trying to comfort him? And
well, there wasn't a lot of time for small talk. I said, well, the short hairs are going to be hard to get out. We're going to have to tweezer those. And the longers, we're going to use tape or we can use depilatory. And you got a lot of acne, you know, follicles that could be infected. And I want you sleeping on your side. It was all practical stuff. Like, he knew I was there for business. So that first day I went probably... I had a 12-hour session on his front and back, just getting everything right because we were close to, you know, filming. And then the small talk started, you know.
Well, and even during the time, I mean, that 12 hours is a long time. I'm sure
you
talked about some things, maybe reminisced about your high school theater days and, you know, really reconnected.
Sure. Well, we did talk character. He liked to talk character and run lines with me. And, you know, I would give him my take or what I felt was right and such. So
you would sort of play Jennifer Grey's role in those.
Yeah, I was never off book, but I would play Jennifer, you know, or Jerry Orbach, depending on the day, you know.
Yeah. And had you been working in film, or was this your first intro into the television industry? Was it through him? And then did you continue to work in this industry after this
film? No, this is my one and only. And then I went back. I have a beauty parlor. You know, I'm kind of retired now, but I had one in Houston for about 30 years.
Did you have a passion for this path in your life, or was it more, I did the makeup in the high school productions and, you know, this is sort of where it led me? Or was there a strong passion for the cosmetology industry for you?
I guess perfect skin is something I've always prided myself on. I was gifted with it.
You have absolutely flawless skin. Yes.
I appreciate that still. I know. And you realize when you have it, it's a gift that has to be maintained. And so I learned all the secrets to making your pores smaller and, you know, strips and creams and toners and such. And I changed my diet.
Did you say cranes?
No, I don't think I said cranes. Did I say cranes? Weirdly enough, if you take a crane egg, the bird, and you whip it up, that is a really good night mask.
Oh my gosh, just the whipped egg and you place it right on the face?
Yeah. You dilute a little bit with some like witch hazel.
Yeah, I think you must have said cranes then. Yeah.
I guess I did. Yeah, I probably did. Well, I'm getting up there, so that is one of my secrets and now it's out. I guess my loose mind is releasing some of my secrets. I had a lot of secrets that nobody knew about. But that's okay.
I mean, since we're sort of here, you're already doing it. Any other secrets you might want to reveal about something you know about the beauty industry that would be helpful for someone like me, you know?
Sure. Well, with Patrick, you know the Vegemite? It's like an Australian thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Vegemite is like I don't know what it is, but you spread it on skin and it pulls all the toxins out. So Patrick used to sleep in a Vegemite saran wrap roll up, you know what I mean? I would I would dress his torso like a mummy and sometimes the arms if he had pimples on his triceps or something, but generally the torso I would put Vegemite and then you know, you sort of scrape it off in the morning and hose it down, then steam it with a towel.
Vegemite comes in tubs or like bottles?
Yeah, it's like a peanut butter tub kind
of. Like a hummus. Okay, cool. So how many tubs would it take to cover his whole body?
Well, he's a big man. He had big chiseled chest and tight abs and great lats and super taut triceps and biceps and really strong forearms and just defined sinewy features, just soft on the touch. Like an Adonis, really, like something Michelangelo would have carved out of marble. I forgot what your question was.
Yeah, it was how many tubs of Vegemite would it take to cover his whole body? Just an estimation, I'm curious.
I guess about a tub and a half.
Sounds like you...
Don't be cheap with it.
Yeah, well, why would you? You know, if your goal is to really make your skin better, like, what's an extra tub, you know?
There were times like, where Patrick was tired and he's like, I can't wear Vegemite no more, and no more depilators. I'm like, all right, well, let's look at the schedule. I'm like, all right, tomorrow you're wearing a shirt, so we can take it easy, you know. And then lo and behold, we get to set and that director's like, I want that shirt unbuttoned to his navel.
Yeah.
And that is like four alarm fire because there was a couple hairs in there. You loosen the front. Now you start seeing a zit on the lower neck and it's like, you got to be ready for that.
It sounds like he had like a real back knee issue.
He did have back knee. That was a bugaboo. Yeah.
Was that ever like gross for you, or were you just so used to this and it never occurred to you to be grossed out by that?
I never got grossed out. No. It was more like somebody makes something better, maybe like an orchestra leader, and he comes in by the end of practice, everybody's good. I felt like by the end of that pimple being popped and squeezed and then, you know, sort of toning down the red, I felt like
an orchestra leader.
Yeah, like an orchestra leader. Yeah, I did something good.
Was any of this painful for him, or was he just, yeah, do it. Let's no problem.
No, he had a high pain tolerance. It was painful because, you know, if you're talking about 30 blackheads.
That's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah, well, he, you know, we were in Carolina and he was jumping in. There's that scene in that filthy lake. And, you know, there was a lot of terrain they were running through and dusty, and he was doing half his stuff, you know, shirt off. So there was no protection from the dust and the free radicals.
So true. And it's funny because I think about that scene and I only think sexy. Like, it's only sexy to me. And so the lake itself was gross.
It was like a sewage pond. It was nasty. It was awful, and he was a sport.
And Jennifer Grey was a sport. For them both to be in there in that nasty, disgusting-smelling, you know, swampy lake that looked beautiful, to be honest.
Well, the surface looked beautiful. He probably put a lens on the camera to cover the filth, you know? And then did that tree scene when they're balancing, and he fell off that. Bug bites. Another thing, too, people forget. Bug bites read on camera, so you can't really pop a bug bite, but you can accelerate it with a poultice and some icy hot.
I didn't even know you could pop a bug bite not on camera. I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, I've heard of popping pimples, but not really bug bites. So that's
in a pinch, you could. You just don't want to leave a crater. And I could do it with a fine tool.
Yeah, you sound very skilled. I mean, you are an expert in this field.
Well, like I said, I had to sustain my beauty, and so I learned. You know, I was the guinea pig for a lot of these treatments.
I mean, your skin is so beautiful, and it sounds like you take such good care of it. Was there ever a time on set where they were like, oh, you know, Patrick's back is just not looking good, but this guy, what a beautiful back he has. Can he just, you know, sort of be the stunt double for this scene and just they show your back? Because it's just, I assume, I mean, I'm only looking at your face and your front, but I assume your back is smooth as can be.
I suppose it doesn't hurt anyone's reputation. There is a close-up in there that's just all back. And it doesn't have to be chiseled and, you know, taut like Patrick's back or that swimmer V, you know, just like a normal man's back. That is, in fact, my back.
Wow. And it's in the scene when they're in bed together?
Yeah. And it was after they shot. Because, you know, I don't know if you know, but in movies, they don't always shoot it in order.
Oh, wow. Really?
So that nasty lake scene happened way before they were in bed, you know, getting it on. So that infection was a long ride, and a lot of the scenes after that, he had a shirt on, but when he was in bed, he didn't have a shirt on.
And that might have made sense for every single other department in the film to have shot that lake early for some reason, but for you, I imagine. I mean, that is the worst thing they could have done to you. Put him in that disgusting, you know, bacteria-infilled lake first, and then expect to shoot the rest of the movie with him, you know, shirtless. And I mean, your job was made so much harder by that decision.
Well, it was like you can have a wardrobe lady say, "Hey, you can't spill coffee on that because I only got one copy of that," or you know, you can have a hair person go, "Well, he can't go in the lake because then his hair is going to be 2-hour reset." But you get a cosmetician going, that lake is filthy, and he's going to get a ghetto of zits." Pardon my language, but densely packed area of pimples on his back if he goes in there, because he's sensitive too. And they don't listen to you. They think you're like irrelevant, or you're not I don't know what they think, but you don't get the respect of somebody.
Just a friend from Texas who got pulled on set, you know, and doesn't feel like the job is actually that important. But
yeah, like nepotism, right? They probably look at you and go like, "Oh yeah, you're somebody's cousin."
Totally.
You don't know what you're doing. But yeah, that's true. They don't respect you. And then I told you so. I said that a million times. You know, they serve tiramisu, and Patrick's allergic to liqueurs. You know, that's got that amaretto in there. Mm-hmm. And I told, don't serve that because he's going to eat it. And then guess what? He had a big old cystic acne pimple right by his left nipple. And that was like really challenging to do it without pain, because you got to pluck hairs there anyways. The nipple's very sensitive. And then you got a pimple with a hair in it, and it was like a whole to-do.
Yeah. You have some, you know, really intense stories from the set of this film that I honestly bet no one would have any idea that your role existed on this film. You did such a good job that they would look at this film and they would see this absolutely beautiful specimen, and they would think, that's God-given beauty. There's nothing, you know, that they did for that. He just is that. But you know from behind the scenes that this was a huge job for you.
Yeah, it was a war. Honestly, it was a war against acne and hair and blackheads. It was, I did not enjoy it. You know, I enjoyed Patrick and the time we spent, but I did not enjoy it. Was rough. It was really, because there was never an easy day. There was never a day where, you know, he takes off his shirt and it's like, oh, I got nothing to do.
Every time he took off his shirt, it was like a new, just surprise nightmare.
Well, like he had like colonies of acne. That's what was weird. Almost like how mushrooms grow and they send spores underneath the ground and they pop up.
Yeah, and it pops up somewhere else.
And you think you got one and you're done. He had that underground network going on his back.
Mm-hmm. When the film wraps, and he's, you know, this breaks his career. You know, were you really proud of what you had done? And did you want to kind of stay with him as the career moved forward? But you said this was your only film. So
I got close to going to L.A. with him to maybe, you know, be his full-time cosmetician. But there was someone that the management team, the machine, set up some meeting with some big shot Hollywood makeup artist and kind of poached Patrick away from me. You know, it happens in boxing when Don King comes in and steals some fighter that, you know, been with the kid for 10 years and Don King makes all these problems. This cosmetic, and if you look at his skin, especially his back in some of those films like Ghost or Julie Newmar Wong Fu, you take a look at his back and that neck that I would have been responsible. It's painted over with some kind of editor's tricks, or you zoom in on that. It's disgusting. There's hairs.
Colonies like that.
Yeah, they didn't exfoliate. They didn't do nothing. I mean, his face, I guess, was fine enough because you're painting over that, but that we didn't use body makeup. That was his real skin. Occasionally, we paint over a zit, but especially the nipple ones you want to paint down because you don't want to have like too large of a nipple because that would be ruining continuity.
Listen, Clint, this has been such an illuminating conversation. I would never have known that your role existed on the film, and it would not have been the same film without you, because everything about this movie is Patrick and Jennifer's chemistry. But really, I mean, it's Patrick. As this guy is so hot, you can hardly, you know, stand it. And he would not have been if I saw colonies and colonies of acne all over his back. So I think you are to thank for the success of this film in a huge part, you know?
I appreciate that honor tremendously. And I like to tell you, when you watch that film or other folks watch it, you watch the scenes where he's got that shirt all the way down to his navel and you look at that chest and it is smooth as a baby's behind, and it is welcoming as a fresh slice of key lime pie that you just want to eat it up. It is just so enticing and smooth and welcoming and gorgeous. I'm proud of that, you know, because the outline, that white crisp pressed Oxford, and then you got his sort of skin tone, but just like in chiseled pecs. And the teasing of the top abs. It is so inviting.
It is inviting. It sounds like you might have been attracted to Patrick a little bit. Is that, am I reading too much into that?
Well, yeah, I guess, yeah, but it was professional. We never, you know, I don't know it would have ever gone anywhere. And we was always friends, so I wasn't going to, you know, really nothing. But, well, he's a beautiful man. Yeah, and I have a wife and kids. It's not like I was going to end up being serious with him, but sure, I was tempted.
Who wasn't on set seeing the film? Who's not, you know?
Well, yeah. And I saw what he was when he was zit riddled and hair riddled. So I still loved him anyways, because I knew what a con man he was. Mm,
that's true. Lifelong friendship. He's so lucky to have had you on this film.
Yeah, it was. It was traumatic. Just the amount of work every day. It was just, he's a big man too. He's a big, big man. And all those muscles make more surface area, as you know.
It's huge surface area. Yeah, of course. Well, I so appreciate the work you did on this film, and I don't think it would have been the same film without you. So
I toned down the armpits too, but we won't have to get into that. He got real bushy there too.
Toned them down.
Yeah. There's still hair, you know, but it's a lot less. And
like trimming.
And we decided how far the armpit hair was going to go. We just said, all right, what do we want these to look like? And then, of course, there was zit. You know, a zit in your armpit is a nightmare.
It hurts, I bet.
Hard for him to hold still when I'm putting a hot quarter on it to kind of pull it out.
I was going to ask you, you know, from what I imagine on set, like anyone who's, you know, got a role in their on set, they've got their sort of bag, you know, the hair and makeup people, they've got their bag. And I assume you sort of had your bag on your hip, too. What was in your cosmetician bag on set?
Yeah. I got, you know, a heating element in case I got to heat up a quarter and draw something out. I got a Vegemite. I got plastics. I got a little like tinter to match Patrick's skin if we don't have time to really fix it. I got, you know, 16 different gauge needles to get inside something and pull it out. Even a mosquito bite, I can make that go away pretty quick. And then your standards, you know, witch hazel, olive oil, Vaseline, and a couple secret, you know, secret things, river mud from Mexico, stuff like that.
And the crane.
Crane egg. Well, crane egg extraction. Yeah, crane egg. Yeah.
Mm. Would you extract that yourself? Did you have a crane that you would do the, or did you have to purchase that from somewhere?
I had a friend who raised cranes and then he would separate it for me.
Wow, another good friend.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I got a lot of good fans.
Well, listen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. This film truly would not have been the same without you.
And is this going to be on like NBC or ABC?
Oh, no, it's just a podcast. It's a podcast called The Novelizers.
So podcasts, it'll be like on HBO?
No, it's just something you listen to. So you could get it on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I mean, there's a couple of different places where you can, but it's just a listening.
Well, my son's got an iPhone. Is that where I'd find it?
Definitely.
So it's on the Apple. It's on the Apple iPhone.
It will be on his Apple iPhone. Yeah. And if it's not on it, you could get it onto that iPhone. I assume, I mean, you have a phone too or no?
Yeah, I got a Samsung. I don't know if I can get it.
I think you can. I think.
All right. And it's Novelizers and I just like call up.
No. You don't have to call up to listen. You can just download the podcast episode and then.
Episode. I'm going to write that down because I got to get someone to help me figure that out. I don't do a podcast.
Clint, we have your contact information because we set up this interview. We can just send you the link and all you have to do is click on it.
Oh, I've done that before. Yeah. I've done Zooms. Not to brag.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you'll just be able to click on it. It will open and you'll
send me a click.
Be listening.
Send me a click to the thing.
We'll send you the click to the podcast.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time today. Really appreciate it.
I appreciate you.
Bye, Clint.
That's it. Special thanks to Stefan Sirachek, Nathan Fillion, and Mr. Matt Walsh.
Next week, we'll have Mark McKinney from Kids in the Hall and Superstore narrating our penultimate chapter with Hannah Pilkus joining us for the interview.
See you then. The Novelizers is hosted by Dave Hill with Stephen Levinson and produced by Stephen, Cole Amoff, Graham Douglas, Kevin Carter, Christine Bullen, Dennis DiClaudio, and Rob Kuttner, and distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. Mixed and edited by Graham Douglas, music by Cole Amoff, art direction by Crystal Dennis. Theme song written by Andrew Lynn and performed by Nick Testa. Follow The Novelizers on Threads, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and support us on Patreon. The Novelizers is an unauthorized work of parody. Copyright 2025, Novelizers LLC. Dave Hill, dance us off stage.
There was a baby put in the corner. There was a guy who could give your mom a boner. He taught her dancing, it took a minute, and she flew into his arms just like an egret. Novelize that movie, write a book, and also read it to me.